The time to act is now. The world is traveling on its axis at 67,000 miles an hour, going somewhere, nowhere, very, very fast. If we can turn this world into somebody we can talk to, we can say, you know what? I don't like you. And then it could say to me, I don't like you either. And we could work from there.
On April 1948, a terrorist organization, Irgun, which was participated in by Menachem Begin, came into existence, and it staged attacks in various places all around Palestine where the Arabs were seeking refuge. And the British participated in this by giving equipment, arms to these terrorists. Prior to 15 May 48, they staged a series of attacks on unarmed Palestinian Arab civilians in a great number of cities, and villages were occupied and inhabitants were thrown out.
Eat the rich, yum, 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 yeah. Eat the rich, yum, 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 yeah. Chemicals in your food. Eat the rich, yum, yum, yeah. Now don't you think that that's rude, eat the rich, yum, yum, yeah.
I remember when I saw the movie Coma back in, I think it was the early 60s, and I it kind of irritated me, you know, such fantasy, such nonsense. Someone goes into a hospital and they wind up in a ward down in the basement and they're kept on drugs and experimented with disease and they finally escape. And it never happened in this country, maybe in Hitler's Germany or something. And then I find out the MK Ultra thing, that exactly that was done in over 200 medical schools and mental hospitals.
What is MK Ultra? I don't recall that.
That was the program, the CIA's program for under the Technical Services Division to experiment on population centers with disease and drugs.
From the serious and the whimsical to the satirical and straightforward informational, we present a potpourri of different types of things, news, special reports, and entertainment, right now on Alternative Views. Welcome again to Alternative Views. We have a mixture of all kinds of different things right now. This being February 1988, a lot of attention is being focused on the Mideast and the Palestinian situation. Well, we're going to give a history of the Palestinian people and the area where they live from their point of view. Also, Blackberry will sing a song called Eat the Rich. Next, former CIA official John Stockwell speculates with us about the origin of AIDS. Did the CIA and the Army have anything to do with it? A lot has been written in Europe and other countries about this, but you don't say anything about it very much in the United States, except in the alternative press. Finally, we'll have a fantasy satire by the Media Process Group in Chicago featuring Stoney Burke and his solution to all the world problems. But before we have these special features, let's have some news stories.
There's been two reports on glasnost in the Soviet Union in these times over the last couple weeks by Alexander Amerasov, who is a Soviet emigre who has been very carefully monitoring developments in the Soviet Union to see if glasnost really indicates significant change going on or if it really doesn't bode all that well as a promising future policy. On the plus side, he reports that freedom to travel has definitely been expanded in the Soviet Union, Jewish refugees and exiles who have left the Soviet Union over the last 20 years for the first time are allowed to return to visit their relatives. They've begun issuing visas and allowing some of the refugees to return to the Soviet Union for the first time. Likewise, foreign Russian citizens have been getting much more possibility to go travel to foreign countries. The Soviet government has been dramatically increasing the amounts of visas that are allowed to travel to foreign countries. On the negative side, the Soviet Union has continued the well-established tradition of exiling Soviet citizens who are opposed to the status quo and then not letting them back into the country. Whereas last year, most of the major political prisoners in the Soviet Union, the most outspoken critics of the Soviet regime, were allowed to be free from the camps or the external exiles that they had been subject to. Several of them were sent out of the country and haven't yet been allowed to return. So the Soviet record is not completely sterling on that. Then there's a report about the struggle for press freedom that is quite interesting. The very fact that there is a debate for the first time going on among the higher circles in the Soviet Union as to whether they should allow genuine freedom of the press is in itself a development, but the fact that they really haven't opened up the media to the extent that a lot of people would like is a limitation of glasnost. In these Times reports on a meeting that was held with the editor of Novy Mir, which is one of the most respected Soviet journals, and a group of members of the Young Communist League, in which there was severe criticisms of restraints in the press in the Soviet Union. The editor of Novy Mir stated, "Soviet citizens' total absence of rights in past years brought us to a very low level of culture. We cannot live this way any longer. We need democracy." He states how a well-known economist sent the Novy Mir a letter that said that history will not forgive us if we don't overcome present conditions in a single leap. We are standing in front of an abyss, and one cannot leap over the abyss in two jumps. Doing it gradually is the greatest threat to glasnost and Gorbachev's other reforms. In other words, the major intellectuals in the Soviet Union are calling for dramatic changes now and a dramatic increase in the freedom of the press.
Doug, I heard on National Public Radio on All Things Considered, where somebody was reporting a conversation they'd had with a Soviet reporter, and the reporter said that whereas before she just kind of had to sneak around and just take handouts from the bureaucrats and the managers of the companies, now they're scared to death of her because she and her little local newspaper have been publishing all this stuff, and the big shots know that they can't tromp on the press anymore.
Well, this is interesting and also relates to another discussion they were having at this meeting, where a question from the floor posed the question outright, do you think the media should be independent of Communist Party oversight? And the editor of Novy Mir, again, this is one of the most prestigious intellectuals in the Soviet Union, said, yes, we need media independent of the Communist bureaucracy and the state machinery. An independent press is a press that would inform us about the killed and wounded in Afghanistan, would give the measurements of radioactivity levels at Chernobyl every day, would tell us about grain purchases, would sit at the meetings of the ruling Politburo and tell us what was being talked about. A cynical voice from the floor chirped in, such a thing will never be. And the editor said, well, if we want to eat our own bread and not American, there has to be an independent press. So there's definite agitation going on to continue the liberalization in the Soviet Union.
An interesting observation, and one that's parallel to some of the problems we've talked about before and Gorbachev has. In the Rio de Janeiro, the Jornal do Brasil, this is reported in World Press Review, says that Gorbachev is not interested in dogma, but in the shakeup of the Soviet system. And it's never been, something like this has never before been seen in the country. Well, I guess you could go back to the old Stalinist days. He shook things up pretty good. But anyway, back to Jornal do Brasil. If there has been acceptance of his plans, there's also been shock in the Soviet Union. Lack of confidence and clear resistance in powerful sectors. It's an uneven match. man against dinosaur. So apparently Gorbachev is up against it when he's trying to take on the powerful entrenched bureaucracy and the military-industrial complex in the Soviet Union.
That's right. And the In These Times report concludes that Gorbachev's reforms so far still lack an institutional and political basis. In other words, Gorbachev and some of his reformers have been able to push through a lot of reforms, and the intellectual and cultural elite seem to have applauded those. But there still haven't been institutional changes that would guarantee these reforms as a permanent part of Soviet life. So they're still up in the air as to what will come out of them and as to whether significant change will really follow or whether this will just be a heroic attempt that will be shoved back by the old communist bureaucracy.
I have a little something from The Nation, and this is from Molly Ivins, who happens to be one of Texas' best writers. She in this particular article, she took on the Texas legislature, which is kind of a local joke here, and in particular, our governor, Wild Bill Clements. Now, you may remember Bill because he was involved in the SMU Play for Pay scandal. And of course, he denied it down the line until he was confronted with the facts, at which point he said, well, there weren't any Bibles in the room.
Are you kidding?
Oh, that's what he said, to explain why he had not told the truth the last time out. And I want to read you a couple of paragraphs from Molly. She's got a wonderful way with words. She says, quote, this is about Bill. The governor's sole charm used to be the impression people had that he was a straight shooter, a politician who'd say just what was on his mind, whether anyone liked it or not. Turns out the man lies like a skunk puts out stink. When asked why he'd lied to the NCAA, he snarled, well, there was never a Bible in the room, unquote. He ran on a promise of no new taxes, which everyone but the voters knew was a lot of hooey. He waffled as far as allowing that the $2.9 billion in temporary taxes passed under the last governor would have to be made permanent, and there he stuck. He couldn't change his mind without looking like a sack full of fish hooks. Lots of politicians paint themselves into corners by making stupid campaign promises. Bill Clements is one of the few to ever survey the situation and apply a second coat. And then later on she says, this is about the legislature, the bill to make English the official state language came to naught, which is just as well since we'd have had to deport the entire state leadership if it ever passed. Clements, denying that he ever paid football players himself, said, absolutely not, that's just repugnant to me.
Repugnant.
He also said he knows the NCAA has a hard task, and he commensurates with them, and he hopes that they secede.
It's so fascinating that cities are starting to formulate their own foreign policy and to carry them out to some respects. For instance, in several areas they're doing this. In divestment, some cities are having divestment of making sure that either they support the various companies that are divesting in South Africa, or they're not giving contracts to companies that do business in South Africa. They also are actually traveling to other countries and negotiating trade pacts. This is happening in San Francisco and Oakland. And they also are instructing the police force not to mess with the people who are in trouble with the Immigration Naturalization Service, because they've declared themselves as sanctuary cities for the Salvadorian Guatemalan refugees. In Tacoma Park, Maryland, they went even further in their nuclear-free contracting law. It's caused difficulties for the procurement office of the city bureaucracy, because the cops didn't like their Chrysler cars, so they wanted the General Motors cars. But the General Motors, unlike Chrysler's, have been involved in nuclear weapons work. And so, by God, the cops ain't going to get any General Motors cars. But now, as far as South Africa is concerned, there are more than 70 cities that have been divesting themselves of and reinvesting millions, billions in assets regarding South Africa and penalizing corporations that actually do business there. Oakland, California, for instance, assesses penalties against contract bids coming from firms who do business with South Africa. So, by golly, if you don't like the foreign policy of the United States, get your city to have one of its own. By the way, this is really freaking out the people in the government, particularly in the State Department. Up in the U.S. State Department, a legal staff said, these mayors have transcended their competence to think that they've become would-be secretaries of state. I think it's a dangerous trend.
Well, a whole lot of cities in the United States have adopted a Nicaraguan sister city and have used these connections to support the Sandinistas in various ways. Occasionally, there's some irony here in which some of the sister city arrangements were set up by the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s when Somoza was in office, and the previous connections were to support the Somoza government. And now, with these well-established connections, liberal groups have been able to turn this around and to use this as support for the Sandinistas. So this is an interesting way that cities can get into foreign policy.
Well, as the mayor of Irvine, California, and his president of the local elected officials of America says, we want to take back foreign policy from the federal government. Mm. That's what they're doing.
They couldn't do a worse job.
Here is definitely an alternative view coming up. Usually, all we ever hear in the United States is Israel's point of view when it comes to the history of Palestine and the Palestinian people. Well, here's how the Palestinians see it.
Palestine actually is a land bridge between the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe. It's the center of the Arab world, a meeting point for Arab East and Arab West. The Palestinians were the descendants of the original inhabitants, the Amorites, Canaanites, Aramaeans, and Arabs. Since 3500 BC, Semites left the Arabian Peninsula in migratory waves and went to Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. In 2500 BC, one such group settled in Palestine, and these were called the Canaanites. Around 2000 BC, a number of states were established in the various lands reached by the migrants from the Arabian Peninsula. In Palestine, the state of Canaan was the first in history to be founded in that country. Around the year 1200 BC, the Hebrews, according to the Bible, led by Moses, fled from Egypt and crossed the Sinai Peninsula, settling in the area east of the Dead Sea. Under the leadership of Joshua, the Hebrews invaded the state of Canaan. The Hebrews were only able to occupy parts of Palestine and the area east of the Jordan River. Their kingdom was founded in the year 1020 BC by King Saul, once again according to the Bible. His successors, King David and King Solomon, ruled until 923 BC. Under the guidance of the original communities of the occupied areas, the invading Jews gained their first experience in agriculture and urbanization. Other parts of Palestine remained under the free control of the original inhabitants. In 923 BC, during the reign of Solomon, the Hebrew kingdom suffered a serious split. The kingdom of Israel took the northern part, while the south was dominated by the kingdom of Judea. In 722 BC, the northern kingdom was swept over by the Assyrians. In 586 BC, the Babylonians brought an end to the southern kingdom, and the Hebrew reign in Palestine was terminated. A very small number of Hebrews remained in the land as residents, most scattered out throughout the world. Throughout this period, though, the original inhabitants kept their continuous residence in Palestine. This was followed by a series of invasions. First, in 538 BC, the Persians invaded Palestine. Next, in 331 BC, the Greek invasion occurred under the Macedonian Alexander the Great. Then, of course, the Romans came in 64 BC. In 636 AD, the convergence of the area of the Great Arab Wave from the Arabian Peninsula took place. From that date on, the Arab identity of Palestine and the surrounding regions has been uncontestably reaffirmed. But the invasions were not over, at least the attempted invasions. In 1099, the Crusaders captured the city of Jerusalem, and the Crusader state of Jerusalem was proclaimed. But in 1187, Saladin recovered Jerusalem and drove the Crusaders out of large areas of Palestine. Then another wave occurred. These were the Turks, the Ottoman Turks. They occupied Palestine from 1517 until 1917, 400 years. In 1917, the Arab people of Palestine and other Arab countries rose against the Ottomans and joined the ranks of the Allies during the First World War. The Allies pledged complete independence of all Arab countries when the war ended. However, also pledged to have a homeland in Palestine were the Jews. In 1897, the first Zionist Congress was convened in Switzerland under the leadership of Theodor Herzl. And that objective was the establishment of a national home for Jews in Palestine. After World War I, Palestine came under the British mandate as required and decided by the League of Nations. This was in 1920. However, 3 years before that, on the 2nd of November in 1917, the Balfour Declaration was issued. Balfour was the British Secretary of Foreign Affairs, and this indicated that the Zionist desire was given official sanction by the Jew, by the British, rather, because the Balfour Declaration called for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Now, the Arab population in the country, in Palestine at this time, was considerably greater than that of the Jews. As this chart shows, in 1918, there were 644,000 Arabs there, whereas only 56,000 were Jews. And this continued, both groups continued to grow, so that in 1948, there were 1,380,000 Arabs in Palestine, compared with 700,000 Jewish inhabitants. And the ownership of the land was also very much in favor of the Palestinians at that time. The Jewish community constituted 8% of the total population, but owned 2.5% of the land in 1918. However, in 1948, following extensive Jewish immigration, their ratio increased to 33% of the population, and their ownership of the land was 5.67% of Palestine. This chart here shows the degree of immigration into Palestine of Jewish people from various parts of the world. Notice that there is a great increase from 1933, 34, 35, perhaps reflecting the drive for power of Hitler in Nazi Germany. Well, the Arab people rose in arms against the colonialism of the British mandate back in 1948. This was put down with quite a bit of bloodshed. Some 50,000 Arabs were killed throughout the British mandate over Palestine in this struggle. These maps show the partitions that were attempted of the area. The one at the left is the partition plan by the British Royal Commission. The Jewish section is shown in black, the Arab section in deep orange, the British section in light orange. And you can see over the years the different mixture of the types of plans which were conspired in by the British. In 1946, the Anglo-American Commission came up with this plan, showing increased British control of the area, once again in the light orange. Well, then there was the United Nations Commission having its own partition plan in 1947, which showed increased Jewish areas for settlement. And then the UN also later adopted a partition plan which gave the Jews considerably enlarged areas of the state of Palestine. Count Bernadotte had proposed one on the far right here in 1948, which partitioned the country, and giving the Jews the smaller northern area and leaving the Arabs with the southern area. However, Bernadotte was assassinated. In the UN partition plan, the Arab section contained 725,000 Arabs, 10,000 Jews, whereas in the Jewish section, there were 497,000 Arabs and 498,000 Jews. In the internationalized area of Jerusalem, 105,000 Arabs, 100,000 Jews. On April 1948, a terrorist organization, Irgun, which was participated in by Menachem Begin, came into existence, and it staged attacks in various places all around Palestine where the Arabs were seeking refuge. And the British participated in this by giving equipment, arms, to these terrorists. Prior to 15 May 48, they staged a series of attacks on unarmed Palestinian Arab civilians in a great number of cities, and villages were occupied and inhabitants were thrown out. As a result of this, the armies of the neighboring Arab states on the 15th of May entered Palestine to try to protect the rights and the lives of the Palestinian Arabs, but they were defeated. Meanwhile, the Israeli armed bands, terrorists, had occupied 78% of the landmass of Palestine. As a result of the 1948 war, Palestine was divided into three sections. The area of Israel, or 78% of the country, the West Bank, which was annexed by Jordan, 20.5% of the country, and the Gaza Strip, which was under Egyptian administration, that was 1.5% of the country. 750,000 Palestinian Arabs were uprooted from their homes, and they took refuge, mostly in really horrible living conditions in camps in the Gaza Strip, Jordan, Syria, or in Lebanon. On 5th of June, 1967, the famous June War occurred, in which Israel fought Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The Jordan West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Syrian Heights, Golan Heights, and Sinai all fell into the hands of Israel.
Israel still occupies all of these areas except the Sinai. The end result of all this has been that
the Palestinians have been spread and dispersed all throughout the Arab world now, with Egypt having 35,000, the Gaza Strip containing 370,000. In Israel itself, there are 370,000. Lebanon contained 260,000 until the invasion. Syria, 170,000. West Bank, 705,000. Jordan, 960,000. Saudi Arabia, 25,000. Iraq, 15,000. And in other places, Kuwait has 170,000. Libya, 7,000. The Arabian Gulf, 18,000. Latin America, 105,000. West Germany, 15,000. And the United States, 45,000. The people have been dispersed, kind of like the Jewish diaspora. It's no wonder that they are resisting, particularly through the PLO.
We'll continue with alternative views in just a minute. First, we want to give you our address in case you would like to write to us. We got letters and phone calls from all over the country. Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Next on Alternative Views is going to be a real treat because it is Blackberry, a folk singer, but he sings political songs. The one we're going to present to you is called Eat the Rich. It's Blackberry's solution to the hunger crisis in the world, I guess. But anyway, to really get the full impact of this song, you have to know something about prominent people in the American power structure, historically. Everybody knows the Rockefellers, of course. And then there is the Mellon family. And J. Paul Getty used to be the richest man in the world. Patty Hearst, Rose Kennedy, and the famous European financier family, the Rothschilds.
When your icebox is bare, eat the rich. show your stomach that you care. So much power, I think it's a shame. I swear they're not the problem, but we know who's to blame. I'm so tired of being manipulized with those stupid guys. The rich. I like to watch TV and eat Hearst patties, uh-huh. Just Hearst patties, uh-huh. We even got something for all of you. Your organic free eats. We got rose hip tea and the tip you see. Cause the rose is the hip of a Kennedy. Eat the rich, yum, yum. Yum, yum, yeah. 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 Oh, the rich have so much power. I think it's a shame. Spreading out the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of being manipulated. That's the stupid game. Eat the rich, yum, yum. Yum, yum, yeah. Eat the rich, yum, yum. Yum, yum, yeah. Now this is the other part of the song. I get to eat me a little bit. I'll say there, buddy. That's a mighty tender looking rump you got. Better watch out. Hey, you over there. Can you spare a rib? You better watch out too. Not now, I'm in the middle of a Rothschild. Oh, the rich have so much power, I think it's a shame. We're spreading out the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of being manipulated, that stupid game. Eat the rich, yum, yum. Yum, yum, yeah, eat the rich, yum, yum. Yum, yum, yeah, oh, the ribs are so much power, Lord, I think it's a shame. It's really not the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired. Come on, y'all, let's go pig out. Excuse me.
We now enter the world of speculation. We're going to speculate about the possible origin of AIDS. A lot has been written in Europe about this, saying that it's different from what we're being told in the United States. We talk with former CIA official John Stockwell about this.
John, I think when we look back in the 1980s, we're going to look at AIDS and Reagan as the two most distinctive and characteristic phenomena of the decade. Two virulent viruses that got out of control and have wreaked havoc on the body politic. Are there any connections between these phenomena? We know that Reagan really didn't respond to AIDS during the first 5 or 6 years of his administration, even though in 1981 scientific evidence came out that we had an epidemic on our hands. Reagan really didn't allocate resources to the medical research in this epidemic, and really hasn't done too much until recently. He now has his testing programs, but he's never really responded to it as a medical problem. Is there any evidence that the CIA or some Reaganites might be involved in the origin of AIDS that first didn't really appear until around 1981? Is this the sort of virus that can be concocted by chemicals or some sort of biological warfare techniques?
Well, there are articles have been written by doctors saying that this thing smells of a man-made virus.
Hmm.
And mentioning this Fort Detrick, where so many experimentations have been done and in devising biological warfare, the diseases that can be controlled, can be used on society. No evidence has come out, nothing that can be cited as proof, and so we can only raise the question. And I have the feeling that if there is evidence somewhere, if there was, it's been destroyed. Another suggestion, not CIA, and mind you, in the context, the Fort Detrick experimentation, in the context of the MK Ultra program of experimenting on the American people with disease and drugs in over 200 medical schools and mental hospitals, a big program that went on a long time, supposedly closed down.
By the CIA.
CIA. Also, the Army was involved, but a lot of the Navy's activities, the Navy was just cover for the CIA.
Oh.
But experimenting on population centers with whooping cough viruses, with other kinds of viruses, dragging a barge through San Francisco Bay, leaking a flu-type virus, to measure that technique for crippling a city. Apparently using swine fever virus, which is very much AIDS similar, to wipe out the hog population in Cuba in 1961. You add these things up and we have every reason to ask if this is not either a deliberate or an experiment or a testing or something that's gone awry done by the CIA. Another possibility, the London Times on the 11th of May had an article sourcing a high official in the World Health Organization who claims that they had he brought out documentation apparently that AIDS was triggered by smallpox inoculation programs of the World Health Organization, and presenting all kinds of massive documentation. The countries where it's hit the worst where they had the massive smallpox inoculations. And then, of course, once it, apparently takes on a life of its own, the history will have to judge some of these things. Horrifying as AIDS is, it primarily the victims, the 25,000 who've died in this country so far, are homosexuals and drug users, the needle exchange. Horrifying as this is, nevertheless, it's limited to one segment of the society. And it's a drop in the bucket compared to some of our major health problems. 800,000 people die each year from smoking-related illnesses. and there is no great furor about that, and that's 800,000 per year. 55,000 a year dying on the highways, a lot of them from drunken driving, you know, accidents and problems, and there's no big furor about that.
And millions of cancer, which is also, at least to some extent, human-made or produced medical problem.
From the pollution of the environment.
From pollutions and additives and preservatives.
And the furor on AIDS, it seems, you know, it's clearly... Now, of course, the argument is that, well, it's potential for growth. You know, there's 75 million people that have it in Africa today, and you know, like numbers here, and there'll be 10 or 15 million now. History will show us whether or not that's true, whether it spreads like that.
Well, do these articles you're talking about, do they discount the stories that AIDS started in Africa with and has spread to the rest of the world?
Well, the stories that I've read indicate that Africa and Haiti were the first places where epidemics of AIDS were found, and then the male homosexual and drug using population of the U.S. So the speculation is that if it was the product of some berserk experiment or some accidental thing like a smallpox vaccination program going berserk, it was then imported to the target population of gay men in the U.S. by someone who wanted to carry out a vendetta against them.
Well,
this is the speculation.
That charge was raised by TASS, for example, in 1983, and some of the more extreme magazines here in the States brought it up, and that struck me as cheap shot stuff. Mm. For one thing, the CIA simply was not uptight about homosexuality. The FBI was, because Hoover was a closet homosexual of the kind that you know would roll other homosexuals, you know, persecuted other homosexuals, and the FBI, he had it very uptight about its homosexuality. The CIA just simply wasn't a big factor, and certainly not enough for the CIA to become, you know, to launch a complicated, perhaps uncontrollable program to exterminate gays.
What about renegade factions of either the CIA or the State Department who heard that there was some virus that was used in some sort of chemical warfare that had been tested in Africa and was found in Haiti and found to be highly effective, and some renegades got their hands on this and used it as a sort of berserk vendetta? Is there any plausibility in this kind of scenario?
I have grave problems with it in the CIA and the State Department, although, you know, if a renegade faction could be two or three individuals, you know, who knows. The segment of society that has delighted the most, of course, is Nixon's moral majority, the Jerry Falwell. You know, it's clearly God's punishment.
Right.
And, you know, whether they would have had someone who could have brought out a disease, this is pure speculation. And I must say, of the kind that does not draw me so much, because we have so much, I mean, you have to keep your mind open to possibilities like that, because so much stuff has come out where we were saying, nah, it couldn't be, or not likely, and then later on you find absolutely they were doing it, the experimentation on population centers. I remember when I saw the movie Coma back in, I think it was the early 60s, and I it kind of irritated me, you know, such fantasy, such nonsense. Someone goes into a hospital and they wind up in a ward down in the basement, and they're kept on drugs and experimented with disease, and they finally escape. And it never happened in this country, maybe in Hitler's Germany or something. And then I find out the MK Ultra thing, that exactly that was done in over 200 medical schools and mental hospitals.
What is MK Ultra? I don't recall that.
That was the program, the CIA's program for under the Technical Services Division to experiment on population centers with disease and drugs.
In what years was this?
It started in the 50s and lasted until the 70s, when Jack Anderson began to expose it, and then the media caught on to it, and the Congress investigated, and the CIA, by the way, destroyed thousands of files of victims, people that it had, you know, experimented upon, so they could never get their files and sue. Mm. And supposedly it was stopped, except it was such a broad program that there was never any one bill that said, stop this. It was just that the exposure made everybody presume that the thing would be stopped. And you have to be very troubled and very skeptical. Not one person was punished. Not one person involved lost a paycheck or was censored or was fired or much less jailed for those, you know, for the experimentation on American citizens with disease and drugs.
In the meanwhile, I ain't going to share my needle with you anymore, boy.
Yeah. No, that, the needle usage and homosexuality is clearly, that's not a fantasy. That's not a myth. That's something where gays should take every precaution, and drug users are just inviting self-destruction by using the needles. And there's so many questions about this thing that I would advocate caution, but I would also, you know, very much like to get inside Fort Detrick's files and see what evidence there might be.
We turn now to the talented people at the Media Process Group in Chicago. They also produce the Access program Labor Beat there. Here we have a combination of satire and fantasy featuring Stoney Burke. It's called The Plan.
I want to change the world into a person! Join me in my dream! The time to move and act is now! We must turn the world into a person! This is the plan!
I agree!
If we turn into a person, you and I can sit and talk rationally about the world's problems, buy it coffee, have lunch with it. Think of the earth as a big lawn that shouldn't be mowed anymore. The time to act is now. The world is traveling on its axis at 67,000 miles an hour, going somewhere, nowhere, very, very fast.
Listen, the world is spinning at 67,000 miles an hour. It's too fast. When I go outside in the morning, I can feel it spinning. It's going somewhere, somewhere. But I don't know where, and we don't know where. If we can turn this world into somebody we can talk to, we can say, you know what? I don't like you. And then it could say to me, I don't like you either. And we could work from there. Or else I could say to the world, what are you doing tomorrow night? And the world could say, nothing. And we could get together. That is a start.
I went to the football game, and the whole stadium was a person. We could play a better game. We'd have a better world. We must turn all the people and all the cars and all the factories into one person.
I'd like to talk to you about turning the world into a person. If we turn it into a person, we could talk to it on a one-to-one basis.
Nope.
Trying to turn the world into a person. If we turn the world into a person, it would be much easier to deal with. Right now, there's too many people, too many big leaders, and if we could just turn it into a person and sit down and have coffee with it.
The Buckeye, you a Buckeye?
No. I firmly believe that time acts now.
If we, are you a Buckeye?
If we could turn the world...
You lost it. Are you a Buckeye?
No, I'm...
What the hell are you?
I'm a person.
Well, God bless you, brother. God bless you. God bless you.
But I've got a plan to turn the world into a person. And if we act now, we can do it.
He's if not going to turn him into a Buckeye.
No.
Man, he's not going to turn him into a Buckeye.
But if we could get all the Buckeyes together and turn them into one person.
But you don't have a Michigan and Buckeye tie, and you're a Buckeye tie.
That's a Buckeye tie?
Yeah, you get a blue and red tie, you'll be all right. You want to turn somebody into a happy,
but
you'll
see,
be okay.
This is the world. There's Buckeyes and Wolverines.
Oh, shit, there's no Buckeye up there, man. Hey,
come on. The time to act is now.
This path to meet is complete. Dunhill covering. Now fourth down. Cooper and Lott were covering.
make the world into a person. This is the world. It's too big. The mountains are too big and the water is too wet. We can't even swim over across the ocean to talk to people. Think of all the trees that fall on the ground, and people pick them up and put them on their houses, and then they forget about them. How would you like to be a tree to forget about? All we have to do is turn all the trees and the water into a person and fight them over to the house.
This is something that was in the Texas Observer, our own Texas Observer, and it's from Jim Hightower, who's the agriculture commissioner in Texas, but he's become something of a media darling nationwide. He gave a speech at the Democratic Convention, and people are just flipping out over this guy. He's a real populist, to use a term that's gone out of fashion nowadays, but some of the things he says are just incredible. I'm going to read a quote from him, and a lot of these statistics you'll recognize from alternative views and like sources. This is a guy that bears watching. This was a speech that he gave to college graduates in Chicago and to the House Select Committee on Hunger in Washington. And he described the Reagan period in definitely radical terms. He says, quote, "From Wall Street to the White House, from the electronic ministry to the corporate boardroom, our nation's ethics are being perverted by the powers that be to serve their own avarice and ideological convenience. From the highest levels of business and government, as well as from too many of our educational and cultural leaders, we recently have been receiving a pernicious message grounded in nothing more noble than a philosophy of greed. I get mine, you get yours. Never give a sucker an even break. Caveat emptor. Adios, chump. As a result, 15 years ago, the richest 1% of American families held 27% of the nation's wealth. Today, they are approaching and likely to surpass the 36% peak share attained in 1929. For the poorest 20% of American families, their annual incomes in real dollars are one-third less than they were 15 years ago. While New York City stockbrokers complain about the difficulty of maintaining their lifestyle on $600,000 a year, one out of five children in America now lives in poverty, two out of five Hispanic children, and three out of five black children. Last year we had 4,022 mergers, leveraged buyouts, and takeovers in this country. They soaked up $190 billion in capital. In the last 3 years, 9,000 companies changed owners at a cost of nearly $500 billion in our economy. For what? Not for new plants, products, research, our jobs, but for paper shuffling, for lawyers and accountants and brokers and bankers and big investors. Hundreds of millions of dollars paid in non-productive fees to achieve non-productive ends. In 1980, nearly 15% of the Texas population lived below the poverty level, which added up to some 2,141,000 people. In 1986, the number had risen to 3,067,000 people, or 18.8%. This is a downward movement of approximately 926,000 Texans into official poverty status. That's a number that exceeds the population of Dallas. Since 1981, over 43,000 good Texas farmers and ranchers have gone out of business. Last year alone, we lost over 14,000 full-time commercial operators. This year, the American Bankers Association estimates Texas will lose 172 agricultural families each week. Farm failures in Texas are already up by 300% in the first 4 months of 1987 when compared to the same period last year. That's from Jim Hightower.
Now let's take a look at an old news story from 1982.
Security and Exchange Commission probers recently found out that Citicorp, that big Rockefeller bank, illegally transferred millions of dollars in profits from banks in their branches in Europe, and they parked them down there in Bahamas. Well, why'd they do that? Because taxes are high in Europe and taxes are low in the Bahamas, even though in Bahamas all it may be is just a little broom closet with a computer in it, and that's the way it is. But the SEC refused to act. They said that Citicorp's pursuit of illegal profit was merely, quote, reasonable and standard business judgment.
You recall in the past we had some reports on Citicorp and Chase Manhattan Bank, how they used to engage in a lot of bizarre international financial dealings that escaped the scrutiny of the Securities and Exchange Commission. They're sort of an international force, so they simply can't be regulated because of the international scope of their operations.
Well, the SEC has done very little, practically nothing, to try to improve or to get the people who have been ripping off the people in the stock exchanges for many, many years either. There's another story also about the SEC and Citicorp. The SEC said Citicorp had no obligation to divulge improper activity of its senior managers because the bank had never represented to stockholders that these officials had honesty and integrity in the first place.
Thank you for watching Alternative Views. We had fun doing it. Hope you enjoyed it. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye-bye.